with you all. It is great to see the sun shining. I haven't seen it in a few months living in England. The things you do for a woman. I teach a lot of American students. We have quite an international center in Oxford, and the students often say, "Oh, I'm just here for a year." And I say, "Be careful, I was just here for a year." If you meet someone, you're going to be here longer than you thought. It has been a real blessing to be here, especially that event with Will, the head of the Atheist Association here on Friday night. It's just great to have such a good tone to the event. Exchanged warm hugs afterwards, promises to be in touch. Felt like we were able to put a strong case forward, but to do so in such a way that those who think differently didn't feel disrespected in any way and still wanted to carry that conversation on. And one thing I really took away from that event as well, which I see time and time again, is that oftentimes intellectual objections can be a shield for what's really going on in someone's heart. And as we listened to Will's presentation and spoke with many of the atheists in the room, so often it was something that had happened to them or even an experience they had had in the church which they had perceived to mean that they weren't welcome, that actually started them down a path where now there were these intellectual smoke screens, and sometimes clearing that away can actually cause someone to ask, is it really intellectual obstacles that keep me from faith, or is it actually something else? Maybe it's really a matter of the heart. Well, this morning, with this first bit of time, I'm going to try to give us a bit of a vision for evangelism and apologetics, tell you a bit about why I'm so passionate about sharing the faith, defending the faith, explaining the faith, and why I think that's really useful and it actually works. And then in our service later, I'll be talking specifically about the question of suffering. Does the suffering in the world disprove or show that it's unlikely that God exists? And this is the area that I did my PhD research on, so it's something that I thought about for a long time. So a vision for evangelism and apologetics. In 2008, the British Humanist Association ran what they called the bus campaign, and they had backing from Richard Dawkins, the famous Oxford atheist. And on the sides of buses, first in London and then throughout England, large colorful letters read, "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And that's Richard Dawkins pictured there. I think it's an amazing advertisement. For starters, the use of the word probably doesn't exactly fill you with confidence. Okay, that berry is probably not poisonous, so go ahead and enjoy it. Our parachute's usually open, so go ahead and enjoy your skydive. Not very promising. But I thought it was also interesting to note what else is implied in this advertisement. It doesn't say, don't worry, because whether or not God exists, he'll be happy with the way that you're living. It says, don't worry, because there's probably not a God, implying that if there were a God, maybe he wouldn't be so pleased with the way that we're living. Maybe there would be something to take into account. I think it might as well have read, don't worry, because you'll probably never get caught. So I think there's actually a lot of truth in this ad, so much so that one director of a Christian think tank in London actually made a financial donation to support the advertisement because he thought that actually it said something quite true. Now, whether or not we agree with that move, one of the things I want to say this morning is that I do think, as Christians, we need to think prayerfully and creatively about how we approach defending the Christian faith and explaining it to others. I think that's a necessity, especially in an age when the objections to Christian faith can even appear on the sides of buses. What can the Bible tell us about what apologetics is? In Acts 26, you may remember the Jewish leaders, they're trying to get Paul executed. And Paul makes his defense, literally his apology. That's where the word comes from, apologia. Paul makes his defense before King Agrippa. And do you remember there how the king responds after Paul's done with his defense? Say again. You've almost persuaded me. It says, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? King Agrippa, he understood that the point of Paul's apologetic, the point of Paul's defense, was to make him a Christian, was to help him see the truth of the Christian faith. And then Paul affirms this understanding with his response. He says, short time or long, I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains. I've called this session A Vision for Evangelism and Apologetics because I think, biblically speaking, it's not easy to make a distinction between the two. Okay, apologetics without evangelism is not really biblical apologetics. So I want to hold those two words together very tightly. The clearest biblical instruction, perhaps, regarding apologetics is 1 Peter 3:15. We can read that together. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer or an apologetic to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. I really like that. In America, you sort of, I didn't even realize I was doing that. You ask people to read something with you and they actually read it out loud. In England, no one would ever think about that. You know, I'm staying quiet unless someone forces me to speak, keeping my private space. So that's good. It's good to be back in America. The first point I think we can take from this passage is that apologetics is not a specialist area of theology. Okay, it's not for just specific people with a specific calling or whose minds work in a specific way. Okay, Peter addresses this epistle to all of God's elect, scattered throughout the provinces. Okay, that's how he opens up this letter. It's a general letter addressed to the church as a whole, not just to an individual or to a specific group of people. The Bible envisions that every believer will, in their own way, in the way God has called them to, be able to give a defense for the reason, for the hope that we have. Now, what would that entail? We go back to the text. I think there's at least four instructions in this text. First, in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Isn't it an amazing thing to be set apart in another person's heart? And isn't it an amazing gift when someone really wants to know you deeply? And when they ask you real questions about yourself, and not just the superficial stuff. If you give a superficial answer, they dig deeper. They want to understand even the difficult things about who you are and what you've been through. They want to understand even the things that other people object to or avoid or even run from. Okay, that's a beautiful thing if you've had that experience. I believe God gets that same delight when we strive hard to understand who he is and what he's done and what his desire is for the world that we live in. When we say to him, help me to understand you better. I know I can not understand you perfectly with my finite mind, but to the extent possible, by your Spirit, help me to understand you more. Help me to understand even the difficult things about you, even the things that other people object to, avoid, even run from. I think it's a common misconception that apologetics is primarily about the mind and not the heart. I think the very first instruction, in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. That's the beginning of the verse that is the clearest instruction about apologetics in the Bible. This is a matter of the heart. When we do apologetics, when we think hard about the reasons for our faith, it's part of our process of getting to know God. And not just the easy stuff, but even the stuff which is more difficult to know. That's a beautiful act of relationship and of worship. And even if apologetics had no other value, despite that value of relationship and worship, I would say that it is more than important to be committed to and to value. A second instruction in this verse. Train your mind so that you're prepared to give an answer or a defense, an apologetic, to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. A couple of things to note here. First, it's assumed that people are asking you questions to give the reason for the hope that you have. So a question for all of us, are they? Are people asking us questions about our faith? If not, why not? Okay, for some of us, there could be a sobering answer to that question. The whole context of 1 Peter is about what it looks like to live a godly life. In 2 Corinthians, Paul says that our lives are letters lived, that we're letters known and read by everyone. It's supposed to be letters from Christ. So there's a question that arises out of this verse. How are we living? Are we living lives that cause people to ask questions about our faith? To ask questions about who we follow? Or have we over time become compromised in our commitment to Christ to such an extent that no one is asking us questions anymore? Second thing to note in this part of the verse is that it says to be prepared. Imagine if you had the chance to interview for your dream job, your absolute dream job, anything that you would like to do. And before the interview, they sent you the questions. They sent you every question that you would have to deal with in the interview. What would you do? You'd prepare, you'd study, you'd spend significant time thinking about these questions, talking to other people about them, researching about them, and coming up with good responses so that when you ask those questions in the interview, you'd be able to give those good responses. Well, I think a question from this passage is, why don't we do that as intentionally with respect to sharing our faith? What could be a greater privilege than being involved in helping someone else to see Christ for who he is and what he's done? How much greater is that than getting our dream job? Something that God could so easily do himself, and yet he's asked us, he's invited us to be involved. And the reality is that we know the questions, right? If I ask you, what are the questions that you sort of hope, if you're speaking with a non-Christian or someone who's not sure what they believe or someone of another faith, and if I ask you, what is the question you hope that they won't ask? You think, if they ask this question, I might be in trouble. Okay, I'm sure that 5 to 10 questions can quite quickly and easily jump into your mind. Not because you don't think that there are answers, but because you think, actually, I don't feel confident responding to the answer to that question in a way which would be both clear and explainable and compelling. Well, if we know what the questions are, and if the questions are that significant, not only to get our dream job, but to be involved in someone's eternal salvation, then why don't we take the time to think about the questions, talk with each other about them, and so when someone does ask that question, actually, we've thought about that question, we know the question, and we can give a confident response. A third instruction in this passage. Do it. Do this. The passage says, do give reasons for the hope that you have. Okay, when I go home to see my family in New Jersey, I'm going home later today. How the spiritual conversations go, I come from a culturally Catholic background. My family's quite mixed in terms of where they are with respect to Christ. How the conversations go is not completely up to me. But whether or not I have the spiritual conversations with my family and my close friends in New Jersey that I feel God has called me to, I do have a role to play in that. I can do that. So I wonder if there are conversations that in your heart you know God is asking you to have with specific people in your life. And my question would be, what is each one of us doing to help those conversations to happen? When I go home to see my family, I like to have one conversational goal for each member of my family. Okay, something practical and concrete. Here is a specific question I want to ask my brother. Here is a specific topic that I want to talk to my dad about. And then I'll share that with my wife or with a close friend so they know that's my intention. And then when I come back, they'll say, how did that conversation go? And that helps keep me accountable to having the conversations that I've been called to. And the fourth instruction in this passage, don't just do this, but do it with gentleness and respect. I found it really intriguing that a couple of years ago, when my wife and I moved into our apartment, we met our neighbors downstairs. And when they found out what I do for a living, they were pretty quick to tell us that they're atheists, that they're on the other side. You have some short conversations with non-Christians when they ask, so what do you do for a living? I say, oh, I'm the lecturer in evangelism and apologetics. Okay. So they were pretty quick to have to find a different lead-in. They were pretty quick to say that they were atheists, but then I thought it was really interesting. There was this short pause, and then they said, but we're not Dawkins-type atheists. As concerned as they were to distance themselves from my Christianity, they were more concerned to distance themselves from the sort of militant, aggressive atheism that they had perceived by someone like Richard Dawkins, who we talked about earlier. Richard Dawkins actually lives about a mile from our offices in Oxford. Not long ago, one of my colleagues, Tom, almost hit him while he was driving on his bicycle, and Tom almost hit him with his motorcycle on his way into work. Tom claims it was an accident. I have to admit, I had a few doubts. So many, I think, of the Christian victories, not in an us-them way, but the Christian victories that have come in debates and other discussions with new atheists have come not just because the arguments are better or stronger or the intellectual case is stronger or better, but because they've been handled with gentleness and respect. And someone can see that actually character can be a means to truth. If this is being presented in a way which is not filled with gentleness and respect, then does that actually tell me something about whether or not it is actually true? I think we're seeing more and more people in England distance themselves. You would know the context in your part of America better, but in England, more and more people distancing themselves, like my neighbor, from new atheists like Richard Dawkins because of the aggressiveness and the militancy of the tone. There was an article in The Telegraph, a major English newspaper recently, where they suggested actually that Richard Dawkins was a double agent working for God. Because actually he's put the questions back on the table in England. It's now a normal thing to be able to talk about these things in public, but he's done so in such an aggressive and militant way that even atheists who live below me are saying, I'm not a Dawkins-type atheist. They're willing to have the conversation, and they don't want to be identified with his way of seeing things, and that opens the possibility of what they do want to be identified with. There's just one other story, not to pick on Richard too much, but one other story which I had to laugh about a bit was this aggressive militant tone. He was in an interview, a radio interview, and he was arguing very aggressively that most of the people who say they're Christians are not in fact Christians because this poll had supposedly shown that they're not able to order the books of the New Testament properly. And the interviewer then, I think, kind of annoyed at the aggressive tone, sort of pushed back to Richard Dawkins and said, well, can you give me the full name of Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species? Because there's a subtitle that comes after the name, and this would be the book that would be foundational for Richard Dawkins' belief in evolution, which is kind of his guiding principle of how the world works. And Richard said, well, yes, of course. And then he called him on it and said, well, what is it? And he said, The Origin of the Species for the... And then he kind of paused. He said, Origin of the Species, the Preservation of... And then he said, oh, God. Okay, so my point is just that he got caught out because, not just because of what he was saying, you know, that's an interesting discussion to have, but because of the aggressiveness of the tone in which it was said. And I think that's the place where 1 Peter 3:15 asks us to be different, to engage with gentleness and respect, to not aim our motorcycles at people, but instead to respond in love, knowing that our God loved Richard Dawkins and any person that we're in discussion with so much so that he came and died for them. I think of one Oxford undergraduate from a while back. He said this after meeting up with myself and a couple of my students. He said, I feel like God sent you there and me there just at the right time, and I really appreciate being able to talk further over coffee. You actually took my concerns seriously, and I was surprised to find that there were decent answers. that was really encouraging to me. You actually took my concerns seriously, and I was surprised to find that there were decent answers. I don't think he would have been open to finding that there were decent answers unless the concerns had been taken seriously in a way that made him feel that we approached him with gentleness and with respect. About a month after that first interaction, he gave his life to Christ for the first time. If I were given only one word to describe evangelism and apologetics, I might choose translation. Hey, that might be a decent word to choose. How do we translate the full and universal truth of the Bible and the gospel for each particular person and place and time? And how do we do so amidst the challenges of mistranslation? Sometimes literal mistranslation, where people actually get the meanings of the words wrong. Here's what Dawkins has to say about faith to the millions who have read his books. He defines it this way. He says, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Okay, that's a severe, just mistranslation of a biblical notion of what faith is. Faith goes beyond evidence. But saying that faith is something that we believe in because of the lack of evidence is a severe mistranslation. I think sometimes even more dangerous than literal mistranslation can be what you might call cultural mistranslation. These are cases where the translation is not strictly untrue, but it's either inaccessible, or it might even carry connotations with it that distract from the gospel rather than explaining it well. This can be the case, for instance, when we speak in theological language that may mean nothing or may mean something very different to the people that we're talking with. Words like sanctification, justification, sin, grace, glory, atonement, salvation. These are key words in the Christian tradition. I'm not saying that we should do away with them. Not at all. In fact, many of these words came to exist precisely because there's a richness to what Christianity is that couldn't be encapsulated by just the normal words that we had in our English language. But I think we must also communicate these words skillfully. A very high percentage of the words and concepts that as Christians we take for granted, okay, may be quite alien to people of other faiths or to people who don't believe, who may not be used to speaking in that language. So take this statement, for instance. Jesus is Lord, and we are his followers. We seek to submit to him by surrendering every area of our lives to him. Now, personally, I'm very happy with this statement. That expresses core elements of what I believe and what I hope will be true of my life. But in this fairly standard statement of faith, I think there are at least four words that are often just utterly taboo in our culture, that can bring connotations and meanings with them that we may not think about because we're so used to using these words in a Christian context. So the word Lord, for instance, can harken back to a sort of feudal system, someone lording something over you, a system of domination and repression. Followers can be problematic. I mean, we're taught to be leaders, not followers. This is one of the first things that you're taught as a child. So then it's very interesting where now all of a sudden you're told to be a follower, perhaps rather than a leader. How about submission? To most people in a secular context, this speaks of the weaker partner in a relationship not having a voice of his or her own. It's symbolized in the sport of wrestling with a submission hold. Okay, not exactly the sort of position that you want to voluntarily put yourself into. And finally, the word surrendering in that statement can bring with it the ideas of shame or defeat. Now, I remember never surrender was sort of a battle cry of my youth, one of the first things that I was taught. And so all of these words, submit, surrender, Lord, followers. Translation is crucial. Please hear me when I say we shouldn't give up on any of these words. Far from it. These words are beautiful precisely because the Christian faith was so rich that it required us to use words in a different way. But we still need to recognize that sometimes we use words in a way that when someone hears it and they haven't grown up in a Christian tradition, or they've moved away from a Christian tradition, what they hear and the connotations that they may actually be receiving may be quite different than what we're trying to communicate. And so we just need to be aware of that, and we need to help explain, by that, here's what I mean. And that's how that's played out in my life, and that's why that word for me is something that brings me great joy and doesn't speak of repression or of something quite negative. I'm glad you like that, too. I like that. In that case, you know, he's using comedy to translate the idea of sin. He's connecting it to our personal experience. We've all been at a party like that where you try to tell a story and all of a sudden somebody else has a story that tops yours, and every time you say something, yeah, you, me. We've all had that experience. He connects with the personal experience, and then he puts accessible words onto what we've already affirmed by our laughter. All of the non-Christians who are in that room, they're laughing at that experience. They're affirming by their laughter, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. And then he says, why do people need to top other people? What is it about the human condition that people get something out of that? Okay, great questions to raise when people have already affirmed that, yes, I do this, and I've been there, and I've seen that, and then to ask those significant questions. So we're not all going to become Christian comedians, but like Brian Reagan, let's think creatively about how we can help people to connect their personal experiences with truths from the Bible and from the gospel, and then to put language onto it, which they can access and they can understand. Okay, the first prophetic act of the church was to speak in a multitude of languages that could be heard by people from all around the world. Now, we're not going to have time to learn every language, whether literal languages or cultural languages, but I do think we need to learn the languages of those we sense God is calling us to. So that's one of my questions today. Who is God calling you to evangelistically? Do you know? Okay? And do you understand their cultures? If it's the homeless, have you ever been out on the street late at night in a context in which you at least start to get something of the sense of what the context and the culture would be for a homeless person? If it's Muslims, have you ever been in an Islamic context where you have some sense of how Muslims actually relate to each other in a religious way? If it's teenagers, what are you doing to understand youth culture? Okay, much of our study in evangelism and apologetics needs to happen outside just the walls of the church, where we actually step into the context and understand something of the context that God is calling us to. And I think in this we follow the example of God, who understood that the best way to share himself with human persons was to inhabit their context. Okay, to come and live among us, the Word made flesh. And so how are we going to put flesh onto the proclamation of God that we have been called to? What's our time frame? Yeah, just a little bit past 10? Yeah, great. One of my favorite apologists, Blaise Pascal, 16th century, French, was a mathematician, had a great conversion, became a theologian and a philosopher. He says we must make people wish it were true and then show them that it is. We must translate the Christian faith so that its richness and beauty can be appreciated. Okay, but sometimes, even when the faith is well translated, intellectual obstacles can remain. I'm going to talk about one of those obstacles at length during our service when I talk about the question of suffering. I really want you to hear me when I say we can't prove faith in some sort of mathematical way. Even if you could, proving something is not for someone to have faith in the biblical sense. You can't argue someone into the kingdom of God. But as I started to say before, and certainly was the case in my story, I had put up intellectual objections as a smokescreen because I didn't want to have to deal with what was actually in my heart. And it was easy to not have to deal with that if I could say, well, the reason I don't believe in God is because of suffering, or because of science, or because there are other religions, or whatever is the case. And sometimes, if we can have compelling answers to some of those questions, we can clear out those intellectual obstacles, and then someone's caused to ask that question, okay, if it's not actually the intellectual objections that keep me from faith, well then what is it? I think in my case, I had to admit that for me, it was that I sort of hid in my heart what the famous atheist Friedrich Nietzsche was audacious enough to put to paper. He said, "If there were gods, how could I bear not being a god?" Very honest statement. If there were gods, how could I bear not being a god? I liked being my own god, and that was at the root of why I wasn't a Christian. But someone helping me to clear away my own smokescreen of intellectual objections really helped me to ask those questions. And I think that when we do that, when we help people to clear away some of those intellectual objections, we're in very good company. I think we're in biblical company. If you look at the acts that Jesus' disciples performed in the Acts of the Apostles, you'll find all of these words: reasoning, arguing, persuading. That's the word that's most used when someone actually becomes a Christian. Persuading, examining, debating, disputing, explaining, defending, refuting, convincing, even proving. All of those concepts are used to explain what the early church was doing. They were doing a lot more than that as well, but all of those concepts are used to explain what the early church was doing in the Acts of the Apostles. So if you commit to having a strong grasp of the intellectual case for Christianity, as the apostles did, I think you'll find that what they found, that the case is very strong. I'm going to not say too much more about that now, but I will talk about that question of suffering significantly in just a little bit. If we just move to the slide number 21. If I had more time, you'd be thankful to hear that I don't have more time. I would tell you that I think every one of these arguments and more that I could put on the list are compelling reasons to believe in God, and each clear away intellectual obstacles that might be in the way of someone seeing the gospel for what it really is. And many of them I could tell you in 3 or 4 minutes. Okay, you don't need to be overly complicated. God has given us reasons to see that the Christian faith is intellectually credible and can stand up against any other worldview. And if we take the time to do some of the study of those things, like the study of the questions that we know people will ask us from time to time, then we'll be in a better position to give the reason for the hope that we have. Of course, there are arguments against Christianity as well, but really, the arguments against Christianity tend to be one form or another of the problem of evil. The idea that in some way or other, suffering disproves the existence of God. I don't think there are other strong arguments against the Christian faith. And when you stack up the number of arguments, positive arguments, that you can make for the Christian faith, and then put that against really one major argument, which I'm going to try and deal with significantly today, I think that's a really encouraging place to be in. Probably the most influential British philosopher of religion of the last 50 years is a guy named Richard Swinburne. He held the head post in philosophy of religion in Oxford before he retired. In 2003, he published this book, The Resurrection of God Incarnate. And in that book, he argues that on the available evidence today, the historical evidence, the philosophical evidence, he concludes it's 97% probable that Jesus truly, physically, miraculously rose from the dead, okay, proving that he is the God that he claimed to be. Okay, I think that's a remarkable thing to be able to say. Now, he recognizes that the number is just an estimate. You can't take the exact percentage too seriously. But nevertheless, the fact that someone of his intellectual credibility can make that claim in print, have it published by Oxford University Press, and then ably defend that claim at top academic conferences all around the world, I find incredibly encouraging with respect to the intellectual case for the Christian faith. A former warden of one of the Oxford colleges, Austin Ferrer, he was a friend of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Dorothy Sayers. I think he puts things helpfully. He said, "Though argument does not create conviction, the lack of it destroys belief. What seems to be proved may not be embraced, but what no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish." Moving into my last section here. no matter how strong the intellectual case for Christianity is, that doesn't matter if we don't wind up in quality conversations that center on Christ. The majority of us will have our greatest evangelistic impact not through preaching or through upfront speaking, but through conversations. I think that's also true for me. I think arguably, perhaps controversially, but arguably it was true even for Jesus. The gospel suggests that Jesus spent a lot of time having conversations and that he was really good at it. I don't think that we take conversation seriously enough as an aspect of Christian discipleship. If I ask you if you are better at your job today than you were 10 years ago, hopefully most of us say yes. If I ask you if you're better as a parent or as a grandparent than you were 10 years ago, hopefully most of us say yes. If I ask you if your biblical knowledge is better today than it was 10 years ago, many of us hopefully say yes. If I ask you, are you a better conversationalist today than you were 5 or 10 years ago? At least in my life, that's a harder question for me to answer. Okay, if I preached a terrible sermon, let's hope that doesn't happen in a bit, but if I did, that would weigh on me. I'd feel bad about that, okay, and rightfully so. If I let a string of obscenities fly in a moment of anger, that would be frustrating to me. I'd feel frustrated with myself. But if I had an uncreative, uninspiring, utterly boring, put-you-to-sleep conversation with someone, I usually don't think twice about it. I don't think that's really a big deal. And if someone's just not good at conversation, we don't take that as a failure in discipleship. We sometimes just think, oh, that's sort of endearing. We don't take that to be as significant of a thing. I think that's an error in Christian discipleship. I was encouraged by William Wilberforce, right at the center of Britain moving away from slavery, fighting against slavery. He was a great personal evangelist, really passionate about sharing the faith. He had something which he called launchers. And he would spend an hour or more after dinner, and he would just sit with God and pray, and he'd have a notepad out, and he would write down the names of people that he felt God was asking him to be in good relationship with, to ask questions of, to share him with. And he would just write things down like this. I have an example. This is from Wilberforce's journals. It says, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what books are they reading? Give them good ones, perhaps Walker's sermons. Call on Mrs. Smith and talk a little. Lend her Venn's sermon. Inquire about the education of their children. What can I be praying for? Invite them to come some Sunday to Battersea Rise to hear Venn. Call often and be kind. I think that's great. You know, someone might say, oh, there's something manufactured about that. I don't think so. You know, if it was somebody's birthday, we might throw them a big surprise party. We might be intentional about planning how we could have a really positive interaction with them. If we were going on a first date, we would think hard about how do we have a really good interaction with this person the next time I'm with them. Well, why not just for normal conversation? Or why not if we know we're going to see someone at an event or at a party or at a gathering that we haven't seen in a while? Why not spend time with God and think through what specific question could I ask them? What conversation would God maybe lead me to have with them? I used to think it was remarkable how quick Jesus is on his feet. Of course, I still do. I still think that's remarkable. You know what I mean. He's always coming out with these amazing lines. Why do you call me good? You who are without sin, throw the first stone. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but to God what is God's. It's kind of depressing. You know, those are the sort of lines that I always come up with about 3 hours too late when I'm driving home. That would have been just the thing to say. Now, I'm still just amazed at Jesus' conversational gifts. But I've begun to wonder, it is certainly Jesus being quick on his feet, but is it just Jesus being quick on his feet? Or did he perhaps spend an hour or more after dinner the night before sometimes thinking, I know this is exactly the challenge that the Pharisees are going to put to me. I know this is exactly the question that they're going to attack me with, and how will I respond to that? How can I love them best and help them to understand who I really am and challenge them about the things that they believe? And maybe he was also spending time with the Father, thinking through those things and being prepared to give a reason for the hope that he has. Paul uses the analogy of a race in 1 Corinthians 9 to talk about the seriousness with which we should pursue effective evangelism, effectively sharing the faith. And to do so, he says we need to go into strict training. I love that little phrase, strict training. We all probably have an image in our mind of something in our life that has required strict training. For me, it was sports. And one of my great frustrations since when I first became a Christian was how hard I sometimes found it to find a community within the Christian community that was as disciplined and willing to go into strict training and committed to each other and loyal to each other and willing to make sacrifices for each other as what I had found in high-level sports teams. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Here are a group of guys who have come together simply because they can all kick a ball pretty well to win the most perishable of crowns, a league title. And yet there's that sort of strict training that goes into the goal that they've been called to. Well, how much more should it be the case for our calling as a community to go and make disciples of all nations? And what would it look like for this community? What would it look like for Open Door to go into strict training for that amazing calling that we've been given? Every one of us probably feels inadequate for that task. I know I often do. But I just want to say as we start to close, if we're willing, God will use what we have. One of my students this year in Oxford, he became a Christian because someone invited him to church. He decided he'd go along out of politeness. He showed up. The guy who invited him overslept, never showed up. The guy walked in the back anyway, sat down in a back seat. Sermon was on John 15, just the scriptures just pierced into his heart, gave his life to Jesus Christ in a dramatic way. The guy calls him several hours later to apologize for never showing up. Can you imagine? You invite someone to church, you oversleep, don't show up, and by the time you call them to apologize, they become a Christian. So encouraging. God will use what we have. And a couple of months ago, just one more example, I had an email from a guy who I had met with maybe two times about 6 years ago. And I remembered distinctly feeling after those conversations, I didn't do a very good job. He had some good questions, and I didn't do a good job answering them. And I don't think I've left him in even slightly a better place than he was in when he first came to me. And 6 years later, I get this email. Dear brothers and sisters in Christ, I am saved. I have no idea when this happened, but on Tuesday evening, after a long conversation with two friends, I was forced to acknowledge the fact that I belong to my God and that he would never let me go. I still feel some trepidation when I look at myself, but when I look at Christ, I know he will never fail me nor forsake me. There's a great deal in my life that needs to be changed, but I know that I will never again be without refuge or resource, that my hope is now in my rock and redeemer. I'd be very glad if anybody who is inclined could pray that my life would be consecrated to God, and that more and more I live to the praise of his glorious grace. So I just want, I guess, to invite everyone to join in. I think it's amazing. God could so easily build his kingdom without us. He could speak to each person in a dream or in some other way or just speak directly into their heart. He doesn't need us to actually share himself with the world. And yet he's invited us to be a part of that which is just most significant to him. Okay, what a privilege. And regardless of how much trepidation we have about that, even if what we feel like all we have right now is, I can invite someone to church and oversleep, God will use that if we are willing. Great, I'm going to end there. Do we move into a... What I was hoping to do, tell me if this is okay, Pastor, but...